On this episode of The Big Number, we dive into the stats to recap the biggest stories from NBA Media Days with Kawhi and the Clippers to Giannis's championship hopes and everything in between. Plus, Jonathan Kuminga signs a deal with the Warriors at last. All this coming up right now. Welcome, 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 welcome to The Big Number. I am Tom Haverstrow, and as always, I am joined by the illustrious Dan Devine. Dan, you are our man, he is your man, and I want to know, how is our man doing on this fine Wednesday as media week continues?
Well, Tom, I've put on 15 pounds in the offseason. I'm not going to say whether it's muscle or lean mass, but I've put on 15 pounds this offseason. I'm ready to play at the fastest pace of my life until my hamstring starts barking, which, by the way, there was an undisclosed injury for me in the year. So actually, I'm not hitting the ground running starting in the season. I'm every media day cliche at once. We're going to be more aggressive. We're going to play fast. We're going to get a lot of threes up. We're going to try to win the possession battle. And also, half our guys are actually secretly hurt. So I'm all of it at once, Tom, heading into media week and training camp. The only thing I'm not doing is I'm not in Dubai. A friend of ours in the media world has asked, like, hey, were you traveling with the Knicks to Dubai? And I was like, brother, I'm shocked they let me go to Westchester to cover media day, let alone foot in the bill to Dubai. I don't think that's happening. But anyway, Tom, you are right. Media day for everybody has happened. Training camp is now moving forward. And I'm ready to put up some numbers. So hit me with it. What is this week's big number?
This week's big number, Dan, is zero, as in the number of total pieces of evidence that the Los Angeles Clippers provided on media day that they did not commit cap circumvention fraud. Hey, Dan, zero pieces of evidence. That is this week's big number. I don't know what we were expecting in terms of what they were going to give us. We got Kawhi Leonard. We got Lawrence Frank, Ty Lue. Steve Ballmer did not speak this year's media day, even though in media days of past, of yore, he sat next to, you know, Joseph Sandberg, the co-founder of a tree planting company at media day. But I don't know what that guy is doing right now, but I can tell you he was not present for this year's media day with the Los Angeles Clippers, and neither was Steve Ballmer. But we did get Kawhi Leonard first time talking about this aspiration endorsement deal that, as Pablo Torre finds out, has illustrated and detailed over five episodes now of, I would argue, not clickbait. Not clickbaity. This is thousands and thousands of documents that they've poured through, bankruptcy filings, court documents, public filings, financial filings. This is not some sort of drive-by hit job. This is a legit deep dive report from Pablo Torre and his team, Amin El-Hassan, David Sampson, and Metal Arc Media. This is something that I was waiting to see what Kawhi Leonard would do, but he basically said, nothing to see here. This is old news. And fake news.
You can't forget that part.
Fake news, right? He was saying conspiracy theories. I don't pay attention to conspiracy theories, clickbaity stuff. Journalism, which was great, is just like, journalism. I'm going to throw that in there that we're just going to shrug off. So what was your take on, just big picture thoughts on Kawhi and Lawrence Frank reading from a prepared statement and having a media availability this week?
Yeah, I think anyone who expected like extended extemporaneous conversation about this from Kawhi Leonard is probably not altogether familiar with Kawhi Leonard's game when it comes to being in front of the podium, in front of the microphone.
He would be a perfect accomplice in this, you know, if the allegations are true. A guy who just loves to say nothing.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think, honestly, the fact that he even said, like, you know, that when he answered, Ramona sort of asked, were you paid what you were owed by Aspiration, by this company, what you were contractually obligated to get? And he said, she said, I believe it was reported as $7 million. And then he even said, like, no, it was way more than that for sure. and that he deigned to acknowledge the reporting that happened and even like cast any aspersions on it, that he went beyond nah or like no comment or I'm not going to talk about that, that he went,
oh, I was owed way more than $7 million. Right. You know,
I was shocked.
Elaborate. Yes. Yeah.
No, I don't intend to elaborate any further on that. That like didn't surprise me. It's a bummer. It struck me as funny. Again, I'm not going to hang anybody else on this one. I'll hang myself. As somebody who has performed clickbait, who has written it, who has been part of, I don't consider that to be like the main part of what I do as an MBA writer, but sure. At times in my career, the first ever, like after I started freelancing for Yahoo in 2009, I got hired full time in 2012. Literally the first day I was full time, the first blog post I was assigned to write was about Chris Humphries' sister getting a plus size modeling contract. So like, and that was at the height of Chris Kardashian, Humphries, Kim Kardashian wedding nuptials, the whole bit. So like, listen, I've been in the mines. I've done that work. Yeah. Six episodes, 6.5, 7 hours of audio, thousands of pages of document review. This is not clickbait. It's a different thing. Anyway, all that to say, like, the idea that Kawhi Leonard is going to say, well, this was all old stuff. There's nothing new to see. I didn't do anything wrong. None of us did anything wrong. We're not going to comment on it. And that Lawrence Frank, again, as you mentioned, like prepared statement, leaning into just the idea of we didn't do anything wrong. We're confident that'll be true, or that will be borne out as true. And just like continuing to talk about we're excited for the truth to come out. We're eager for the truth to come out. As a layperson and a simple man, I'm like, if there is an alternate explanation for all this stuff, and all that stuff isn't the truth, and the alternate explanation is the truth, and you have it and know it, and you are eager for it to be revealed, it would seem like there's a pretty direct way to do that, which would be to tell it, right? Yeah. Like to tell the truth. To say what happened and to say why this stuff is wrong, and the continual, declining of the opportunity to do that, and saying, "Well, the NBA is going to do its job, and we're going to let that happen." It's not shocking. I don't even know if it's disappointing. It's just sort of like it feels like there's a gap between what you guys are saying and what is happening.
The cognitive dissonance here, is baffling. We are very confident that the investigation, we invite such investigation. We want them to dig through everything because we will be proven to be innocent in all of this. And what is your proof of this? Because Dan, wouldn't you imagine if they had a document or if they had a video of Kawhi Leonard planting trees or lifting a finger for this endorsement contract? We would have seen it by now, because that would be a huge piece of exonerating evidence. Is like, look, he was paid an endorsement contract, and here it is. Here's his big video. We've seen in the press Leonardo DiCaprio backing this company. Like, it's been publicized that Leonardo DiCaprio is endorsing this company. Robert Downey Jr. endorsing this company, Drake endorsing this company, Cindy Crawford endorsing this company. We haven't heard anything about Kawhi Leonard endorsing this company, Dan. Why is it a secret? Why is it a secret that Kawhi Leonard, who on this week said he is owed more than $7 million, or implying that he is owed more than $7 million from this company because of an endorsement deal, why, if it's such a lucrative endorsement deal, and he says, I don't think it's accurate that he didn't provide services for this deal, why wasn't it not known? Why is this a secret? Why, when you sign this endorsement contract, which by its very nature, an endorsement contract is you're endorsing the company publicly.
To promote it.
No one cares if you're endorsing. Why would Aspiration or Ford or FedEx care if you're endorsing this company at your picnic table with your kids? You need to talk about it publicly. That's the whole idea. It's the whole idea of a marketing deal, is get out there and market our company. And he didn't do anything publicly, and it wasn't even known that he had this deal. So I just, it is zero pieces of evidence. And I thought it was interesting when Ramona Shelburne was pressing him from ESPN, was pressing him about the nature and the details of this endorsement contract and the fact that he didn't do any services, or it doesn't appear that he was doing any services. He said, I don't think that's accurate. And then he quickly evaded the rest of that answer. Didn't provide any details. Didn't say, I did a photo shoot or I did a video shoot. I did a whole commercial for them. It didn't see the light of day. Because, Dan, it would put the whole thing to rest. It would put the whole thing to rest if Kawhi was like, look, I was on set. We taped a commercial. I did a bunch of tweets and it's in my drafts and on my Twitter feed. But you know what? It never saw the light of day. And so I apologize. That would just clear everything up. Do you think Lawrence Frank and Kawhi Leonard and Steve Ballmer want this hanging over them as we go through the season? No. So why don't you just show the evidence and be done with it?
Yeah. It's again, the part of my brain that is aware that I'm not a lawyer is like, I'm sure that there is a tried and true explanation for that, where it's like the idea is you say nothing because anything that you can say, even if what you feel like it's going to be like exculpatory, it's going to be something that totally exonerates you. Anything you say is potentially able to be used against you. So just say nothing, right? Again, Kawhi seemingly a pretty great avatar for this strategy. But it does not square, as you said, with the comments and the attitude of the organization saying, like, we invite this investigation. We welcome the finding of fact here, particularly considering, and, you know, I went back this morning and I watched Kawhi's whole media day session, all 6 minutes and 55 seconds of it or whatever. And It was, by my count, 7 different outlets asked questions. You know, Ramona, you mentioned, only 2 of them were related to the investigation and the aspiration, you know, controversy. And I thought this was really interesting from Steve Henson at the Los Angeles Times, LA Times, like the daily in Los Angeles, right? The main daily
paper of record
in that market.
Yep.
Quote, the Clippers allowed only 2 reporters to ask about the deal during media day at Intuit Dome, refusing to give the microphone to additional reporters, including one from the Times, who raised their hands to ask questions. Leonard was ushered off the dais and out of sight. And so, like, we talked last week, I was at Knicks Media Day. Very frequently, your starting point there is the local beats, right? Like, they're the local beat writers who are on their deadline for covering this team for the major local papers. They're going to get their questions in first. They're going to get the opportunity to be kind of like leading the dance in the scrums. And then, you know, people from other outlets and, you know, national people, et cetera, sort of move from the outside in. The idea that you're saying we're limiting this to like a handful of questions, we're only doing a couple on this one, we're not letting the paper of record and the market get in on it. It's if nothing else, it seems like you're saying we welcome all sunlight on this, and then you're kind of putting a pretty big sun blocker on it, you know, to prevent that kind of daylight from coming in.
Yeah, it's a great note by you, and I was thinking about Lawrence Frank and his response to, again, it would have been nice if Kawhi Leonard had been receiving questions from other media outlets that, like the LA Times, that have some very directed, poignant questions that would feel like it would be them opening up for any questions. It's a media day availability. It's media day. And I remember Law Murray, our friend from The Athletic, who's covering the Clippers, he had a question, but right before he asked the question, you could hear someone on the PR staff say, last question, we're wrapping after this. And I was like, and what we're seeing from the LA Times report is that they had their hand up. If you have nothing to hide, then why are you cutting these interviews short? It doesn't add up. And then Lawrence Frank, when he's asked about Uncle Dennis, I don't know if you caught this. So Ramona Shelburne is asking Lawrence Frank whether he had any knowledge of Uncle Dennis, Kawhi Leonard's representative and manager, whether he had any knowledge of Uncle Dennis asking for extra benefits that go beyond the scope of what's allowed in the NBA. And he says to her, look, Dennis knows the rules. Kawhi knows the rules. Mitch Frankel knows the rules. And we know the rules. And she goes, is that a yes or no? And he goes,
good
yes.
Good follow-up.
We all know the rules. Now, if you're sitting at home and wondering, that's a weird response. That's a non-answer to did Kawhi's camp ask for cap circumvention, essentially rerouting money or extra benefits that doesn't fit under the rule book. He didn't say no. He said, we know the rules. They know the rules, blah, blah, blah. If that sounds eerily familiar, that is because Steve Ballmer had almost verbatim the same response to Ramona Shelburne, again, asking the same question to Steve Ballmer on ESPN in hours after the first Pablo episode dropped. He said, they know the rules. They, meaning Kawhi and his representatives, including his uncle. We know the rules. And if anything's not clear, we remind ourselves what the rules are. And we make absolutely clear we're going to abide by those rules. And they understand them as well. And it's important for them to abide by them, which they have. That last line is a little different than what Lawrence Frank had said.
Yeah.
Is they know the rules, but he didn't add, and we know they abided by those rules. Steve Ballmer said that a couple weeks ago, said Uncle Dennis knows the rules and they abided by those rules. Now, I there's lots of lawyers involved. You can tell from Lawrence Frank's opening statement, a 2-minute opening statement, that he was looking down on his sheet of paper, taking his eyeglasses off, having hand gestures that were reminiscent of politicians of years past. It seemed practiced. It seemed very choreographed. That doesn't seem like someone who is really confident in their innocence. It seems like if I were the Clippers and I was that confident about my innocence, I would put away any prepared statements and just be like, ask me anything. And I'd be able to speak off the cuff because I know we're clean. We're good. But the between Kawhi and Lawrence Frank, I don't think they avail themselves very well in this and creating confidence in the public that they have nothing to hide here. I know they said they have nothing to hide and that they're clean and that there's no secrets here. But the fact that you will not answer Ramona Shelburne's question about Uncle Dennis's extra benefits in a very genuine way, where you're not evading the answer, it's just, why do they keep sidestepping this issue and just provide us with the evidence that they're good? You know, it's just, yeah.
Yeah,
it's just bizarre.
There's an Occam's razor explanation for that. But I suppose in order to publicly arrive at that, we'll need to see the outcome of the NBA's investigation and Wachtell Lipton digging into it. And if I was Wachtell Lipton, I would say, you know, I think we're going to need some more time on this. We're going to need to build some more hours on this one. Really, you know, put a pot of coffee on, get the midnight oil going to see what's going on here. But yeah, it does feel like if it was as simple as we did nothing wrong here, there's a lot quicker and more direct way to arrive at that than where we are now and what they did on Media Day, which was kind of like, wait, you know, leave Kawhi till the very end of the day, put him up there for 6 minutes, let two questions be about this, and then cut it off. And yeah, it does not exactly scream we're an open book and confident in our responses to this. It seems like we're trying to, you know, make sure you're looking someplace else, which, I mean, maybe that gambit will pay off. You know, we're about to get into training camp. We're about to get into the season. The Clippers are expected to be a team competing for, you know, one of the top spots in the Western Conference. We did whole episodes about how the Clippers remade their team in the offseason. There's a lot to be interested about and dug into there, but not a single person's going to give a crap about that while this is all hanging over everything. Kawhi Leonard can say this is not going to be a distraction for us. Lawrence Frank can say this is not going to be a distraction for us. I think we're going to see about that once the season starts.
Yeah, none of us did no wrongdoing.
Which, yeah. I mean, you get what he means.
So
you get what he means.
I get what he means there. Yeah. But I'm like, going with the is it a triple negative? Is it a double neg? None of us did no wrongdoing, Kawhi said. So he said, that's it. We invite the investigation. It's not going to be a distraction for me or
like the investigation's
the
a vampire. Like, it can only come in if you invite it. Guess what, guys? The investigation was coming in whether you opened the door or not. That's kind of the way where we arrived at after all these podcasts and the subsequent reports from other outlets. The investigation was coming whether you welcomed it or not. But I guess it's nice that you're going to put some treats out for the investigators as they come. That's good.
That wasn't the only big media day, media week story. We got our four biggest media day stories and headlines that we want to go through. After the break, your four little numbers and our biggest storylines from media day. All right, Dan, zero is this week's big number. Zero pieces of evidence that the Clippers provided at Media Day that they did not commit cap circumvention. In light of the five-part series from Pablo Torre Finds Out, I don't know if we were expecting one or two or three, but it would have been nice to get at least one. So four little numbers, your first little number about big headlines, big storylines from Media Week. Dan, well, what's the first one?
We're going to dramatically leap from zero to two for our first little number. Our first little number is two, as in two NBA championships, as in a second NBA championship, which Giannis Antetokounmpo would very much like to win. And he confirmed on Media Day, although he did not attend in person, he was in Greece as he has contracted COVID and was, you know, waiting for a negative test so he could fly. So hopefully he feels better soon and all around him stay healthy. But Giannis confirmed during a Zoom on Media Day, a second championship remains his goal as he enters a dramatically changed situation in Milwaukee. He confirmed the accuracy of offseason reporting by Shams Charania at ESPN that Giannis would be open to the possibility that his best chance of winning that second ring might be somewhere other than Milwaukee, and he's continuing to evaluate his future. Mm-hmm. And here is Giannis himself. Quote, "The same thing that I've been saying my whole career. I want to be on a team that allows me and gives me a chance to win a championship, you know, and that wants to compete at a high level. I think it's a disservice to basketball. It's a disservice to the game to not want to compete at a high level, to want your season to end in April, you know? So it's pretty much the same. It's not the first time. I had the same thoughts last year. I had the same thoughts 2 years ago. I had the same thoughts 5 years ago, 2020. It's never going to change. I want to be among the best. I want to compete with the best, and I want to win another championship. And that's it." Wow. In fairness, Giannis also said some nice things. He praised the addition of Miles Turner. He said that John Horst, the general manager, had assembled, quote, a team full of dogs. And he called the Bucks a sleeper and a very, very dangerous team. But the thing that you wind up thinking more about is that he confirmed Shams' reporting from the summer and that he's thinking about that second championship. So, Tom, what did you make of Giannis' Media Day commentary?
You just blew right past the funniest part of the whole press conference.
Oh, no. What did I do?
Wes Edens, the owner of the team.
That's right.
Had said at the Media Day availability that I had a great conversation back in June with Giannis. It was great. He committed to the city. He says he loves it here and his family loves it here. And he wants, you know, he wants to be here long term. And then Giannis, when he was at the Zoom call and was asked about that conversation with the owner of the team, he said, "Who? You said I talked with Wes? I do not recall that.
I don't recall that conversation
with Wes." Oh, man. Yeah. Oh, that's got to hurt. I don't remember it. Could have just, you know, played along and just be like, yeah, had a great conversation. No, instead he denied.
That's
not
my guy.
Yeah. So that was really funny. I do think that is interesting, is that Giannis is on one hand saying, I like this roster. I like what they did. But on the other, wasn't really playing along with, hey, I've talked with ownership and I feel great about the future here. But Wes Edens had a different account of that meeting. So the thing about Giannis is, look, Dunks and Threes are one of our favorite websites that does projections, win-loss projections based on player impact ratings, their EPM numbers. They have the Bucks at -2.5 adjusted net rating projected for this season. That is good, or I don't know if good is the right word, but 17th in the NBA. And it's partly because there's really nobody of real consequence behind Giannis on this team. And so if he's injured or anything happens to Giannis contracting COVID and he has to stay away from the team, it could go south really quickly. And so the fact that he is, you know, yes, saying I like this roster and everything, the numbers and the projections are saying otherwise, is that this is not a title contending team. Certainly not. I mean, 17th best rating according to the individual numbers, with Kyle Kuzma, one of the most negative players in the league, having, I think, third or fourth most minutes projected on this team. That is not a ringing endorsement by the numbers, but yeah, that's where they're at trying to get that number two championship.
Yeah. It's you understood the move to move away from Damian Lillard while he was going to be a lost season for him, rehabilitating from the ruptured Achilles and turning him into the cap space to sign Miles Turner. Like, there's something to be said for that. you are looking at a guard rotation that's Kevin Porter Jr., Gary Trent Jr., Cole Anthony, AJ Green, Ryan Rollins, Gary Harris. And like,
yeah,
that some of the, like, you need the coin to come up heads a lot in that kind of collection of backcourt talent to be able to ease things up on Giannis and space the floor for him. And like you said, God forbid anything happens to Giannis. But all right, number two, maybe not in the offing, and then maybe the Bucks will be in a different kind of number two before too long. Our second little number this week is 30.9%. That was LeBron James's on-ball percentage last season, according to NBARAPM.com. It's a big honking stat site with all different kinds of fun bells and whistles and numbers. On-ball percentage is what it sounds like. That means that when LeBron James was on the floor last year, he had the ball in his hands about 31% of the time.
I love this stat, by the way. I'm glad you brought it to light because I feel like it's one of those stats that should be more ubiquitous. It should be everywhere, the on-ball percentage.
Yeah, it translates the idea of like time of possession or usage into just like how often is that guy literally holding the ball? Like it's a pretty simple thing.
That's a big number, is it not?
It is. It's in the 92nd percentile in the NBA. So it's, I mean, the highest of the highs. It's, you know, your Jalen Brunsons and Trae Youngs. That's up near 50%. But LeBron, just under 31, that's still like 92nd percentile in the league. In his 22nd season, it's still one of the more ball-dominant players in the league. And above him on that list, and I think the 97th percentile, was a guy named Luka Doncic, who is obviously signed an extension in LA. He's going to be with the Lakers. He's going to be the focal point moving forward. So LeBron talked on Media Day, among a number of other things, about whether he's going to be retiring or not. We'll see. About whether, you know, he's going to wait for Bryce. Not so much. You know, all the different kind of things that he was talking about. He talked about the importance of working on his catch and shoot game and his off ball game, in an acknowledgement, tacit or explicit, that he's going to need to find ways to fit better alongside Luka. He said, I got to understand how I can make the most of when I don't have the ball, you know, moving into space. Obviously, Luka and AR are going to do a lot of time handling the ball. We've got Marcus Smart now. Gabe, Bronny, when he gets his opportunity, they handle the ball. We got a lot of guys that can handle the ball. So how can I be effective on a team where I don't have to handle the ball as much? He took just under 3 catch and shoot 3-pointers per game last season. The highest volume that he's had in the tracking data era was 22-23. He had 3.5 again. So it's not like giant usage as a catch and shoot player, but he shot the ball really well on those last year. I think 42% on catch and shoot shots. He's still one of the most, you know, dangerous cutters in the game when he moves into their lane off the ball. Just under 1.55 points per possession finish on a cut to the basket last season. He shot 80% on basket cuts last season, but he only did it about once a game. So my question to you is, I think this is one of those things where people see something that can work and they talk about the value of it on the first day of school. But do you think, Tom, that this is like everybody's on their best behavior as the season starts? Or do you think this is real? Like, is LeBron really going to turn himself into more of an off-ball player now that he's playing next to Luka?
Feels like he has to burn a lot more calories for that to happen. You know, it is strenuous to have the ball in your hands and try to get by people. But also, cutting requires activity and requires you to be sprinting when maybe you don't want to be sprinting and maybe you're trying to catch your breath as a 40-year-old in the NBA. So I'll believe it when I see it. You know, like, it just feels like LeBron. I remember early in his career covering him in Miami, he had really good post-up numbers, efficiency numbers, but it wasn't until 2011 when he got embarrassed by the Mavericks did he realize, actually, you know what? I got to use this more. I got to go to the block more. And sometimes that embarrassment is what is going to get LeBron or anybody to eat their vegetables, right? So for LeBron, I kind of feel like he's accomplished enough in his career that I don't see him turning into, Dwayne Wade off ball cutting and the ghost cuts from D-Wade. But I'm going to go a different direction here.
Okay.
With my second biggest headline here from Media Day is, did you see Anthony Davis's eye, dude? Like,
it looked gnarly. I mean, it was like a detached retina in the offseason, right?
A detached retina surgery. And apparently he suffered this injury April 2nd. So it's been, do the math, what, 6 months?
Yeah.
And he still has this red eye, which he says is because of the eye drops that he had. And it's not actually due to any sort of like structural damage or any sort of issues. But he did reveal, and this is one of the things, not just visually Anthony Davis is different, but he did reveal that he's going to have to wear goggles for the rest of his career because of this injury. And that's a big revelation from Media Day, especially because he was the player to come back from the Luka Doncic trade that was widely panned and widely considered the most lopsided trade and most stunning trade in NBA history. And here you have a guy who just months later has to wear goggles and had to go detached retina surgery. So this is concerning also because Anthony Davis is one of the most high volume foul drawers in the NBA. Him going through contact is Anthony Davis. So if he's at any way hindered about drawing contact and getting to the free throw line, last year, 7.8 free throw attempts per 36 minutes, was top 10 in the league behind Luka Doncic, Jimmy Butler, Paolo Banchero, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, Zion Williamson, Joel Embiid, Giannis Antetokounmpo. Like, he's one of the best at drawing contact and going through the basket and getting to the free throw line. And if he's any way impeded by that eye condition, then his value as a player, I think, declines quite a bit.
Yeah, I mean, you combine that with the hemming and hawing in Dallas about when Kyrie Irving is expected to be able to be back on the court, where Nico Harrison said during, I think, a Summer League broadcast that Kyrie was ahead of schedule. And then Jason Kidd came out right away and was like, can we stop saying that? He's not ahead of schedule.
Did he say like it was bad reporting?
Then? Yeah, right. Him and Kawhi, we're blaming the media an awful lot, you know, but
journalism.
Yeah. You know, he's not here for these clickbait analysis of what his general manager said on TV. And then Kyrie coming and saying, I'm right on schedule. So we'll see when that means he's back. But yeah, the idea of this competitive window over these next few seasons was largely about what you got out of Kyrie and AD. And if you have impeded versions of either of them, obviously it dramatically impacts what you can expect from the Mavericks on the court. Still going to be fun to see Cooper Flagg though. So we'll see how much we see them. Our third little number this week is -12. That comes to us via Nuggets head coach David Adelman, who answered a question that I think was asked by our guy, Matt Moore. I'm not positive, but I think it was him, about how to address Denver's perennial struggles when Nikola Jokic hits the bench. Here is what David Adelman said, quote, I think that's one of the biggest challenges at camp because I'm not worried about how the starters are going to flow together. It's just trying to find the right group with that second unit. We can't be -12 every night in those minutes. It's just a killer. And he went on to talk about like the challenge, the reason why that's a big killer. If you lose the non-Jokic minutes by a ton, then you're in close games all the time. If you're in close games all the time and you're not blowing anybody out, you're not resting your starters in the fourth quarter, you're playing guys big minutes, they wind up having heavier workloads, and then come the end of the season, they run out of gas. And that's obviously when you're playing for championships, that those margins can matter a lot. -12, I looked at it first. I was like, is that a specific thing? I think it was an estimate, but the numbers are not great. Over the course of 100 possessions, the non-Jokic minutes during the regular season last year, -9.3 per 100. In the playoffs, the two rounds, -22.2 per 100. So yeah. Maybe -12 is just sort of in the middle of those. But this continues a career-long trend, massive on-off splits for Jokic. It's only gotten bigger as he's gotten better. So, Tom, I guess the first step to solving a problem is identifying it. What do you make of David Adelman circling those non-Jokic minutes and saying, we got to solve for X?
Yeah, I think it's very clear that the Russell Westbrook experiment did not work, of him anchoring that second unit, being the sixth man in that role. It did not work. He's not with the Denver Nuggets anymore.
Anybody right now. Yeah, that was one wild thing from Media Day, remembering, oh, right, he's not on a roster right now.
Correct. And the Denver Nuggets kind of started a little bit of a... the Denver Nuggets are, you know, with Jonas Valanciunas and all that controversy wherein he signed with a EuroLeague team and he was threatening to leave the NBA, but then he's back and he's going to be part of this Jokic tandem in the front court. And, you know, they need help there, but I don't know if Jonas post-ups is really the answer here. I kind of feel like when you're looking at the second unit, and they got Bruce Brown, they got Tim Hardaway Jr., Julian Strother, Peyton Watson, Jonas Valanciunas. That is a pretty solid second unit. They don't have a point guard. They're going to run through Brown and Jamal Murray next to Jokic. And so they don't have like a traditional point guard really on the roster. And so a lot of this is going to come on Jokic. Last three postseasons, you mentioned the regular season and postseason last year. I did last three postseasons plus minus of when when Jokic is on the floor in the postseason last 3 years, +169 when Jokic is on the floor, -96 when he's on the bench. Oof. Over the last three postseasons. that swing is a 250 point swing there over the last
monstrous.
Three postseasons.
Yeah.
So the issue in the regular season, great. Like, okay, it's one thing in the regular season, but it exacerbates in the postseason, like you pointed out. I also noted kind of Jonas, the acquisition of Jonas and having Jokic out there, maybe you get two big lineups. The other thing I noticed at Media Day is over in Houston, Ime Udoka, he said something really interesting, you know, coming off the heels of Steven Adams playing a lot of two big lineups with Şengün in the postseason last year against the Golden State Warriors. He noted that he is going to be going to probably the biggest lineup in NBA history, or one of the biggest lineups in NBA history, is Amen Thompson, KD at the two, Jabari Smith Jr. at the three, Alperen Şengün at the four, Steven Adams at the five.
PJ Carlissimo, you were just ahead of the game putting KD at the two back
that's
in
right.
Seattle.
What was it, 20, almost 20 years ago?
Jeez, yeah, that's right. My goodness.
Think about it. So I went on Basketball Reference. The heights of these players, 6'7", 6'11", 6'11", 6'11", 6'11". So the average height of that lineup is 6'10 plus. Dan. Oh, my goodness. So he's like, we're going to do things differently without Fred VanVleet. We're not just going to go double big. We're going to go four bigs, essentially, four 7-footers. And Amen Thompson, who's 6'7".
It's like the Onion story. Like, it, we're doing five blades. Like, we're just going all we're just going all in. We're going to make those like the Cavs teams that was like Jared Allen and Evan Mobley and Lowry Markkanen. We're going to make those guys look tiny. We're going with everybody big.
Yeah, so Dan, I don't think they're going to try to recreate Fred VanVleet. They're going to try to create something actually that we've never seen before. It's just like an all 7-foot lineup. Can we get Clint Capela in there as the fifth spot there?
I'm sure he can handle the rock. Yeah, what the hell? Why not?
Sure. This week we've always been asking for is Clint Capela. When can he handle the rock more? Please run point for this team.
Just got to let him cook. I think Ball is still on the market. We got to have as many options as we can. All right. Our fourth and final little number this week is 10. That is how many total possessions the Cavs played last season with Donovan Mitchell, Evan Mobley, Jared Allen, DeAndre Hunter, and Sam Merrill on the floor together. So three of their core four, Mitchell, Mobley, and Allen, and then DeAndre Hunter, their big trade deadline piece, and then Sam Merrill, sort of designated shooter off the bench. They didn't play together at all in the regular season, according to Cleaning the Glass. They played 10 possessions together in the playoffs, which is not very much, but that looks like it's a low number, and it looks like that's going to be the starting lineup for the Cavs entering this season, because you've got Darius Garland still working his way back from the offseason toe surgery, and Max Strus is only about 5 weeks past surgery to repair a Jones fracture in his left foot. So two spots open on the Cavs starting five. DeAndre Hunter is going to slide right in there, and then Sam Merrill to keep that floor spacing and add, move Donovan Mitchell to the point guard, have him be at the two spot, maybe a more natural position for him. One big driver of Cleveland's success last year, their big turnaround where they won 64 games and the number one seed in the East, was that they were really healthy. The year before, they'd had a ton of injuries, but last year they lost the 10th fewest games to injury in the NBA, according to SpotTrack, and none of them were extended injuries to their main guys. Now they're going into the season with two injuries to starters. They also lost Ty Jerome in free agency too. So, still expected to be the class of the East, still expected to be right there with the Knicks up at the top of the conference. But does the prospect of going in without two starters and with an unproven started five give you any pause, Tom, about the Cleveland Cavaliers?
Yeah, because the number one predictor of injury is prior injury. So if you are injured going into the season, that's not a great start. And it's one of those things that, we find out at Media Day is whether guys are wearing goggles or they have a limp or suddenly they have a new arm sleeve tattoo. And it's like, whoa, hey, where did that come from? We learn a lot on Media Day, and it's not just like these press conferences where we get really good information and updates and catching up. We also learn of these injuries and like what are the timetables here? And for the Cleveland Cavaliers, it does concern me, especially when you're dealing with some of the injuries that they're going with and the speed of Darius Garland and how he's going to be able to come out of the gate without training camp, without a ramp up is really concerning. On that note, he is not the only all-star point guard that is dealing with an injury coming into postseason, the preseason here. Not just Kyrie Irving, not just Darius Garland. I'm talking about De'Aaron Fox, okay? We've talked about Fred VanVleet. We knew about that injury. We knew about Darius Garland's injury. We knew about Kyrie Irving's injury. Didn't know about a hamstring injury for De'Aaron Fox, who just was richly awarded with a four-year, $222 million max extension this offseason, and he's coming into training camp with a hamstring injury, which is alarming for a guy whose wheels are his best attribute in the NBA. So when we talk about media day revelations or big storylines, I feel like we're kind of sleeping on this one. Is De'Aaron Fox coming into the season with a hamstring injury that we didn't really know about? Now he's hopeful that he's going to be ready for the opening night. And they do have Dylan Harper, although he's dealing with injury too. And they do have Steph Castle, the rookie of the year last year at the point guard position. But they said bye-bye to Chris Paul, and now he's over in Clipperland. So for me, there's a couple other injury stories out of the gate here that are worrisome, and you highlighted Cleveland. Definitely worrisome. I think they still will get the number one seed just by virtue of all the injuries at the top, but it is a little concerning that their starting five is so inexperienced together. They have played a lot kind of here and there, or three-man lineups, four-man lineups with those names together. But this is not a great start for the Cleveland Cavaliers in a very opportunistic season. And I think also De'Aaron Fox getting a max contract and starting the season a little behind, that's not what you want to see.
Jordan McLaughlin minutes. That's all I'm looking for. If you don't know him, do your Googles. Jordan McLaughlin, important part of Minnesota teams of years gone by, plus minus God. Get him up there behind Stephon Castle in the backcourt and see. So let him cook next to Wemby. Also, just like in terms of the size differential, Jordan, J Mac, and Wemby, pretty good. So we need that in our lives. But yeah, I mean, the margins in these conferences, or in the West especially with San Antonio, margin's going to be real slim with how much talent is there, how many teams think they got a shot at the postseason. You get off to a slow start because you don't have your backcourt that you had anticipated, and the Spurs, even with Wemby back fully cleared, could find themselves in a tough spot.
Well, we're going to talk about another tough spot that had ended. And maybe we're just kicking the can down the road, because there's so much interesting here of Jonathan Kuminga finally agreeing to a deal, a two-year deal, according to Shams Charania over at ESPN. We've got lots of thoughts about this. Believe it or not, we've been covering this all offseason, and we finally got a resolution to it. We're going to talk about it coming up right after the break. All right, Dan. So we talked about the Nuggets, the Lakers, the Mavs, Houston. We talked about the Clippers, a lot of Western Conference teams. One team we haven't talked about is the Golden State Warriors. And according to Shams Charania, our long national nightmare is over as of 6:34 p.m. Eastern. Yes, that's right. Jonathan Kuminga saga is over. He had agreed to a two-year, $48.5 million contract to return to the Golden State Warriors. Agent Aaron Turner told ESPN. But this is my favorite line of this report. The deal has a team option designed for the contract to be ripped up and renegotiated next summer. What? Like a two-year deal, but it's the second year is designed to be ripped up and renegotiated next summer. So does that make it a one-year deal? I've never heard this kind of verbiage around a contract, but Jonathan Kuminga did not get his player option that he was requesting, that there was kind of back and forth all summer. And Aaron Turner did a lot of interviews publicly trying to campaign through the media about his value and trying to get the word out that he would like to have a player option and no team options, because those are a net negative for a lot of these clients. It's like, team options work against players, which is why maybe you want to include in this report that it's designed for the contract to be ripped up. So according to the reporting, it's going to be about $22.5 million in year one. There's going to be a no trade restriction until January 15th. Mid-January is when he can be traded first. It seems like this is just kicking the can down the road.
Yes.
And designed for him to be traded. So it isn't a two-year deal. It might be just like a half-season rental with the Golden State Warriors is how I'm reading it. How are you reading it, Dan?
Yeah, it calls to mind, you know, like NFL free agency reporting, where it's like, this deal can be worth up to a certain amount. And then, you know, your smart NFL people are always like, let's see the guarantees, because this 5-year, $96 million deal is really like 2 years, 38, and then everything else is void years and sort of incentive laden and stuff like that. My immediate reaction to it is the Warriors got basically exactly what they wanted in this situation. They did not go to a third year. They did not give up a player option. They did get, according to the reporting, Jonathan Kuminga to waive the implied no trade clause that comes with signing a one guaranteed season extension. And, you know, for the team that's got your bird rights. So they still have the ability to move him this season. They have the team option that allows them to control what goes on next, or a potential suitor to control what happens next for Kuminga. They get him on the larger salary slot that allows them to bring in a higher priced player or to target higher priced players in trade if they want to try to add to this year's roster.
Right. Like veteran guys who have in the $25 million range. Right.
Yeah. So my initial reaction to this is sort of like, if this is where we were, why could not this have happened very long time ago? But I suppose the answer to that is Jonathan Kuminga didn't get nothing in return here. He does get a little bit more money up front, right? The if the initial offer was 2 years, 45, getting up to 2 years, 48 and a half, there's a you start at a higher salary. So he gets a little bit more money now. He doesn't have to take the $8 million qualifying offer. He makes like an additional $15 million in guaranteed money this year. It doesn't get him the immediate exit to get where he wants to go. It doesn't get him the, you know, sign and trade to Phoenix or Sacramento, where he would get a longer, more lucrative deal and a starting slot. He doesn't get everything he wants, but he gets a little bit more money, and he either gets, if he doesn't like where he is after an eventual trade, which I think at this point we just have to assume is gonna happen. If he doesn't like where he gets traded, he can either renegotiate a new deal there next summer or get into UFA in 2027. So he still is like has the horizons coming closer for him to where he can fully control his next steps. It feels like it was a whole bunch of agita for not much payoff, but I think the your point about kicking the can down the road is like, all right, so now Kuminga's there. He's there on this money. Does he start? Do you bring him off the bench as a sixth man? How excited is he about that? If you're the Warriors and you want to pump up his trade value to make sure there's a market for him in January, you can't just stick him on the bench and not play him. How does that fit with the like all grown-ups ball movement, smart play stuff that you've been working the whole thing around? And Al Horford seems like a hand in glove fit for, and you clearly weren't super comfortable with the way Kuminga fit into that. Like now the on-court element of this comes back to the forefront. And I don't know, barring Kuminga changing his game and assenting to doing more of the kinds of things that Steve Kerr and that coaching staff have really been trying to get him to do for a longer period of time, or dramatic injuries and problems elsewhere in the Warriors hierarchy that means more shots, more touches, more usage for Kuminga. It's kind of tough to, like, I don't think we've solved those problems, but yeah, the can has been kicked down the road, if nothing else.
Yeah, it's going to be hard for me to believe that he's going to be on the Warriors past the trade deadline. Like,
yeah.
Simply put, I would be surprised if he's on the Warriors roster come March, and that he is going to be on the team for their playoff run this upcoming season. Al Horford next to him, I mean, he's a kind of a perfect fit for what the Warriors want to do as a passing big, very smart, both ends of the floor, kind of steeped into the dye and the cloth of what Steve Kerr preaches constantly is ball movement. If you're gonna have the ball in your hand, make a quick pass, kind of point nining it where you don't want to hold the ball. You want to make a decision quickly, shoot or move the ball. That's Al Horford's game, right? Yep. He is a guy that can have a 10% usage rate next to a guy like Jonathan Kuminga, right? Is like, all right, I'm just going to be out here to defend and play at a high level, do the little things, and Kuminga, you can just cook. But I just don't know what that does for, you know, Draymond Green's going to slide over to the four. And then you ask yourself, well, where are those minutes going to come from Kuminga? Like you said, is he going to start? What kind of minutes is he going to have? But all of this might be just fait accompli in that the suitors are the suitors. The Kings have been rumored to be interested in Jonathan Kuminga and the Phoenix Suns. And maybe we find out that, you know, come January 15th, they've had some sort of deal, the framework of a deal already agreed to, and they're just waiting for him to get his money, which he did just get. So we'll see. I like the moves that they hit. GP2, DeAnthony Melton, Al Horford coming back. Love those veterans for what they're trying to do. I'm generally bullish on the Warriors year in and year out because I think Steph is that good.
Sure.
And he looks great, and everything that we're hearing about Steph Curry and his strength and his speed and his health, I think is really good sign for the Warriors. What I don't like is just, I feel like, Dan, this isn't going to be the last time we've talked about this on The Big Number, Jonathan Kuminga. I feel like we're probably in for there was a couple reports last year, Kuminga unhappy about his role and wanting to get some sort of resolution with Steve Kerr. And I feel like we're not out of the woods yet on that. So Golden State Warriors, they get Jonathan Kuminga back, but TBD whether he's actually going to be on the Warriors roster and they rip up that contract this summer. Sorry.
Is he like our Pablo aspiration story? Like, are we going to have like a 5-part series on Jonathan Kuminga?
I, you know what? I don't think it's getting the kind of,
don't you put that evil on me, Ricky Bobby. Don't you do it.
Exactly.
Hey, yeah. but you know, but brothers playing together, that's pretty good.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's a Exhibit 9 deal, it looks like, training camp deal
for Seth Curry. That's right,
for Seth Curry. So yes, he's signed, but it's not a full, you know, standard player contract. So it looks like he might like play training camp and preseason and be here for a short while, and then he will be back with the team potentially down the road once kind of the roster restrictions loosen up for him. So that'll be fun. The Curry brothers, we haven't seen that yet in the NBA.
No, I think it sounds like it's going to be good. And the idea of, I think that it's to your point about, we're going to wind up talking about this again. It feels like all of the signings they made, the younger guys they still have there, like with Moody and Pajemski, and the veterans that they had, like this whole team is built to look and play a certain way. And then there's this other guy. It still feels like that. And maybe Kuminga is able to be like, maybe that can turn into a strength, and Kuminga can be, you know, additive as a different type of player and bring a different flavor of downhill slashing and offensive creation, whatever. And maybe this is the year they finally figure out how to merge those two things. I think you're right, though, to be skeptical about that and to think that the most likely outcome here is that the one of these things is not like the other of it all, winds up being resolved in a trade in a couple of months. But at least Jonathan Kuminga is going to be getting paid a little bit more while we're all waiting for that.
You don't have to wait anymore, folks. You were clamoring for the resolution on our over-under on the Kuminga contract that we said
That's
July
right.
30th was going to be $20.4 million. That was the over-under from Fred Katz.
That's
at
right,
The Athletic,
Rip.
Did the survey of coaches and executives. And the average annual salary for Jonathan Kuminga after all of those was 20.4. We both said over on that. We took the over on that, and the average annual salary, even though it's going to be ripped up this summer,
it's designed to be. It's designed to be. Things that are designed in certain ways that don't always happen. You know, like, you know,
that
bridges
was almost
are
like a dare that Shams did. Like, it's a dare. Like, it, don't you dare not rip this up. It's designed to be ripped up. The crease is, it's like a fruit snack that has already had a rip on the label there. It's already designed to be ripped up. Okay.
This so contract will already, self-destruct. Yeah.
It will self-destruct. The little crease has already been created on the contract. And all you have to do, Mike Dunleavy Jr., is just rip it. Just let it rip. All right. So that is, congratulations. We did correctly on Josh Giddey and Jonathan Kuminga, Cam Thomas. I think we were also correct. We're just waiting on Quentin Grimes, which
I can't
we'll find
believe
out.
We're still waiting on Quentin Grimes, but all right. Yeah. Emergency pod incoming. Let's go.
And he didn't get to go to Abu Dhabi, right? Like the flight left without him. So unfortunately, we won't
same,
get into that.
Same, Quentin. Same. You and me together.
Thank you, Emmy. I appreciate you for producing this show yet again about Jonathan Kuminga. Appreciate you rolling with the punches there. And I want to also thank the entire Yahoo Sports squad behind the scenes for making this podcast a reality. Shouts to the Dunker Spot, which you can now check on the Yahoo Sports Network. our friends Nikias Duncan and Steve Jones joining the network. So congratulations to them. And also catch our show on that Fast Channel now, Yahoo Sports Network, yahoosports.tv. Go check it out wherever you watch your free programming. That's going to do it for us this week. Catch us again next week. Go check us out on YouTube and wherever you listen to podcasts. Dan, we did it. We got through Media Day.
That's right. 15 pounds of lean muscle coming your way.